Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Before she was a justice on the highest court of the land, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a gifted and ambitious lawyer. She allied herself with some of the most outspoken voices of second-wave feminism, but her own style was reserved and measured. In the documentary RBG, which opens Friday, our guests, Betsy West and Julie Cohen, unearth Ruth Bader Ginsburg's past and her evolving role in politics and the law. They explore how she journeyed from understated legal dynamo to larger-than-life feminist icon and role model for high-powered grandmas everywhere. From her early days arguing cases before the Supreme Court to her later years, she demonstrates a quiet poise that still manages to be forceful and urgent. You can hear that in the closing of her first argument before the Supreme Court in 1973, in which she quotes abolitionist and women's rights advocate Sarah Grimke.
We urge a position forcibly stated in 1837 by Sarah Grimke, noted abolitionist, an advocate of equal rights for men and women. She said, "I ask no favor for my sex.
All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks."
And that quote opens the new film RBG, and we are very grateful to be joined by its co-creators. On today's Your Call, Betsy West is an award-winning filmmaker, journalist, and educator. She previously worked as a producer and executive at ABC News and senior vice president at CBS News, and she's now a professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and she's here with us in studio. Betsy, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Matt. Great to be here.
And also with us is her co-producer and co-director, Julie Cohen. Julie has directed and produced 8 feature documentaries. Before starting her own production company, Better Than Fiction, she was a staff producer at NBC News, and she's currently an adjunct professor at Columbia in the documentary program. Julie, welcome.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. And so let's just first start with, I think, of course, people know Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a Supreme Court justice. They know her as what has really become a figure in popular culture, right, in a way that really no other Supreme Court justice has. But you, of course, begin the film with her early life. And so talk about, so many people don't know the backstory of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, certainly even going back to the 70s, let alone going back to her earlier life. What did you learn doing that?
Well, that's really why we made the film. Many people know about the notorious RBG because of her scathing dissents on the Supreme Court. Julie and I had both interviewed Justice Ginsburg for previous projects in 2011, 2012. And so we learned about her extraordinary history. So it was about 3 years ago that we were watching her internet fame grow as the notorious RBG, and we looked at each other one day and said, people don't know the full story. Nobody's ever done a documentary. Somebody should do that, and it should be us.
And so when you said, what was it about her backstory and really going far back that made you say, we want to tell this?
Well, people think of her image now, not realizing that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as a young lawyer, essentially created and then pushed forward the whole field of constitutional law establishing equality of rights for the two genders. That's a pretty big deal. And somehow this lady who's super famous now as a Supreme Court justice, people don't even know about her. Like, they know she's cool, but they actually don't know just how cool. Gloria Steinem is so famous for her work in the women's liberation movement, as it was called in the 1970s. Ruth Bader Ginsburg played an equally important role, and we wanted to tell that story.
And how do you understand what started her on that path of really wanting to fight sex discrimination, wanting to use the law to bring women equality?
Well, she was a brilliant student at Cornell, and went to Harvard Law School, where she was on Law Review, transferred to Columbia, graduated at the top of her class in 1959, and she gets out into the world and cannot get a job, basically because she's a woman. She became a professor at Rutgers, And in the late 1960s, as the women's movement was broiling and things were happening, some of her students, and there weren't many female students in law school at that time, but there were a few, and they started asking her about laws affecting women. So she started to research this and realized how horrific the landscape was, and how there were hundreds, if not thousands, of laws across the country that discriminated against women. Sometimes because, you know, men would say, well, it's better for women to not have to work overtime, as opposed to, hey, wouldn't you like to have the opportunity to make more money? Or laws that really gave husbands incredible control over their wives, financial control, where they're going to live, just a slew of discriminatory laws that she recognized. And then in the early 1970s, she partnered with the ACLU and started the Women's Rights Project and began to look for cases that would begin to bring down these laws, that would challenge the underlying assumption that it was fine to discriminate against women.
I mean, I thought one of the really fascinating things in the film was seeing how strategic she was in her approach to trying to make change through the courts. You talk about how when she was a law professor, she was already, I give a sense that she was already kind of forming her way of thinking about this. Talk about what you came to understand.
Justice Ginsburg, from the very start, was a great strategizer. She took the long view from the very beginning. There was a lot that needed to be changed in society as far as women's rights were concerned, and the only way to change it was going to be step by step. And that's what she set out to do. You know, one by one, she would look at these laws. She would take a case, her first case, for instance, that she argued before the Supreme Court, Sharon Frontiero, a woman in the Air Force, unusual for its time in the 70s, came to discover that she couldn't get the same housing benefits that a man in the Air Force could get because she was a woman. The underlying assumption was like, oh, hey, your husband must make a lot of money. Like, so why do we have to give housing for you? That should be kind of the man's thing. Ruth Bader Ginsburg looks at it and says, hey, this is a good case. Like, this is a plaintiff who's really going to appeal to judges, and I'm going to take this case to the court.
I have to say, when you interviewed Sharon Frontiero for the film, she's one of the great voices in the film, right? And what's really neat is seeing the contrast between a voice like her is very plain spoken, like, how could this be? I was just shocked. Coming up against this reality in the Air Force. And then Ruth Bader Ginsburg, such a different voice. And that was really cool seeing her in the context of that movement and of these individuals.
We were so lucky to interview Sharon Frontiero very early on in the process of putting together this documentary. It was one of the first interviews we did, and it was fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, just loved her.
She is such, there's no, feisty is the word. She is one feisty gal now, and she must have been feisty when she was a young woman in the 1970s and came across this. As she says, you know, I thought it was, I'd run into one bigot, and I'm just going to look around and try to correct this mistake that they've made. And then, you know, pretty soon she realizes, she goes to a lawyer, he says, no, this is not bigotry, this is baked into the law, and if you're going to do it, if you're going to do anything about it, we're going to have to bring a lawsuit.
That's the voice of Betsy West, also joined today by Julie Cohen. They are both directors and producers of the film that's coming out this Friday, and that is RBG, all about the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it's a really remarkable film, amazing voices throughout it. And I want to follow up on what you're talking about, Betsy, about this thing of these feisty voices, which, right, that's, I think, when people see the clips of the women's movement from the 60s and 70s, well, that's typical. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg, here she is in that context, someone very different. Julie.
Absolutely. You know, Sharon Frontiero takes the position that she was kind of told, and the societal message was, you know, nice girls don't do this kind of thing. Nice girls don't fight back. Nice girls don't file lawsuits. And she just said, too bad. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had sort of a different approach. She was going to fight the power, but always try to do it nicely. Her voice is quiet. Her tone is, you know, it has sort of an air of peace to it, almost, I would say. So even when she's actually challenging the biggest assumption, and actually, you know, in a sense, if you look at her words, she's kind of telling the male establishment to stick it. She always tried to do that calmly and nicely.
The other thing about what she did shows how shrewd she was is she would pick the cases that were going to appeal to 9 male justices. So the next case that we look at in the film is Steven Weisenfeld. He was a widower. His wife had died in childbirth. He's left with an infant to take care of. He goes to Social Security to get the benefits. He wants to stay home for a few months, take care of his baby, and discovers that, oh, no, you know, we don't have a benefit for fathers. We have a mother's benefit. And when Ruth Bader Ginsburg hears about that case, she realizes what a sympathetic defendant he is going to be. All those male justices are going to take a look at Steven Weisenfeld, who she sat at her table when she made the argument, and they're going to put themselves in his place. And she really always wanted to make the argument that discrimination against women hurts everyone. It's gender discrimination, and it's bad for the society across the board. So she was very, very strategic in the cases that she picked.
You know, everything about Steven Weisenfeld was sympathetic. His story was one that the justices were going to be able to relate to. We had the benefit in our film of being able to add in the photos of the two of them and, like, seeing...
Oh, yeah.
Seeing a father who makes the decision to stay home from work to care for his infant son, who happens to be this adorable little curly-haired toddler. I mean, it does warm your heart, and it's a good reminder of, you know, impact of discriminatory laws can cut across the board.
Well, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg at some point talks about how when it came to talking to the court, to the men on the court at that point, she's a bit of a kindergarten teacher, right? Kind of trying to put them in the shoes or kind of say, what are some other ways that she did that in her arguments?
Well, that was really one of the favorite parts of the interview that we did with Justice Ginsburg when she said that, you know, because it was in response to asking her about the kind of blatant sexism that they would exhibit from time to time, the little remarks they would just toss off. You know, one of the best ones, she's giving a very serious constitutional argument, and Justice Rehnquist says, joking, wouldn't you settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the dollar?
Yeah.
And you know, just that kind of, he thought that was funny.
And then they all just like chortle.
Chortle,
for 20
laughing,
seconds.
And ha ha ha. And I said, how did you put up with this? And she said, well, never reacting in anger. And that's when she said, I just felt I was a kindergarten teacher and I was teaching these men something they didn't understand, that discrimination, in fact, does exist and that it's unfair and that it hurts everybody.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg had a real plus, I think, in going into her career in appellate litigation in that she actually had been a teacher, not a kindergarten teacher, but she had been a college professor for some time, both at Rutgers and at Columbia. And she brought that whole professorial style into her Supreme Court arguments. She decided, like, okay, if these justices don't know this stuff, if they don't understand what it's like to be a woman, because after all, men in society really didn't understand that at this point, like, I'm just going to teach them. And sometimes she would broaden out pretty significantly from the facts of the case, as happened in Frontiero, and really just start talking about the whole history of discrimination against women in our country, which was something, you know, it's hard to even imagine this now because I think we have a firmer grounding in this stuff. But in 1973, like, people just hadn't thought of things that way. As her friend Judge Harry Edwards says in the film, like, they just didn't get it. Like, they were like, what do you mean women are discriminated against? I thought we treat women nicely. We put them on a pedestal. She quotes a great line in her arguments several times saying, like, you know, you call it a pedestal, but often it turns out to be a cage. You know, pretty harsh words, but again, delivered gently, you know, a little bit of sugar and spice goes a long way.
And having been at Harvard Law School when she was, she certainly she knew these men, right? She knew the world that they were coming from and who she was talking to.
Absolutely. She was one of 9 women in a class of 500.
Right.
And she said that you felt as if the men were watching her all the time, judging her all the time. They often wouldn't call on the women because they were afraid. They just felt they couldn't handle it. You know, there were the bathroom was in a different building. It was not a welcoming atmosphere for the women who were there. And then, you know, the dean at the beginning of her term there gathered together the nine women, invited them for a nice dinner, which they all thought, oh, isn't that great? And then after dinner, he pulled them all aside and he said, all right, I'd like you to go around the room here. And would each one of you tell me, why are you here at the Harvard Law School taking the place of a man? So that was what she faced as a law student. She knew the impact of discrimination on her own career. In the end, it worked out okay, though. You know, she might have gone and been a, she could have become a high-priced lawyer somewhere in New York. Instead, she's now a Supreme Court justice. But it took a long route to get there.
And already having the experience of being in this very tiny minority around very powerful men. And how you navigate that. She really learned from that experience. Julie
Cummings. I mean, I think you could make the point that all the challenges and obstacles she faced early in her career really helped her out. You know, she had something to fight back against, and she really fought back. And that's where she developed all kinds of skills and all kinds of toughness, you know, stamina and mental toughness that I think she might not have developed if things had been a little easier for her earlier in her career, and she could have been like any Ivy League law graduate who sort of shifts into a high-end law firm and moves along through that case. She was a fighter because she had to be a fighter.
This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and we are spending the hour talking about the life and career of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg with filmmakers Betsy West and Julie Cohen, talking about their new film, RBG, which is going to be out in theaters this Friday, and very pleased to have them with us. This is a pre-recorded program, so we can't take your calls or emails, but we are happy to bring you this conversation today. And, I mean, going back to talking about her experience in law school, I mean, one of the really big parts of the story, which I think for people who might not know her life, is the role that her husband Marty played from early on in her career. And you make a real point to show at different places in her life what a difference he made. And he, of course, was experiencing going to law school and those struggles at the very same time. Talk about why you thought it was so important to tell that story.
Well, this is a true feminist love story at a time when feminist love stories were not the norm. Ruth Bader met Marty Ginsburg when they were both students at Cornell. She was a very beautiful woman. If you see the pictures, we have some home movies in the film. She was quite beautiful, and she has said that Marty. So she didn't lack for dates. Let's put it that way. She has said that Marty Ginsburg was the first man who cared about her because she had a brain. When they both went to Harvard Law School together. She was a year behind him, basically because she'd had a baby. She had an 18-month-old when she entered Harvard Law School.
Now, that's it. When you think about that, all these other situations, else she's dealing with in that.
Right. Yeah. She says it was an advantage. She said it was great to have a break from the law books to come home and play with her baby. I mean, having had a toddler, I find that a little hard to believe, but that's what she says. She meets Marty. They get married right after she graduates. They go to Harvard Law School together. Marty is bragging in Harvard Law School, my wife is going to make law review. He loved the fact that she was super smart, and he supported her. They went off to New York, and Marty had a very successful career as a tax attorney and was rising up at his firm. And I think in the 60s, she took on more of the role of the household. But as her career took off as a women's rights litigator, and Marty understood how important it was, he took on more of the responsibilities at home. So including doing all of the cooking, partly because he was a much better chef than she was, and the kids kind of revolted at a certain point, and so she never did any more. She never did any more cooking. So this went on throughout their careers and their married life to the point that she was appointed to a judge in D.C. to the D.C. Circuit, and Marty gave up his job in New York, moved down to Washington to support her. And then when the opening came up in the Supreme Court, it was Marty Ginsburg who really pushed his wife's name forward and made sure that she was under consideration.
Now, how did that work? How did that happen?
You know, he just got what she was capable of. He understood, as he followed her career and knowing her, you know, brain very, very deeply, what the potential was, and just felt like it would almost be like wrong for her not to be a Supreme Court justice. So as you can see from a number of clips we have of him in the film, he was an extremely likable, facile, like gregarious guy. People just like loved him. And so as a result, he like knew everyone. You know, he was really well connected in Washington, and he chose to use those connections when a Supreme Court seat became available in the Clinton administration. He chose to use those connections to kind of spread the word throughout D.C. legal circles, which is, you know, not a huge world, actually. So you can get in there and start, you know, spreading it around like, my wife is the one. Like, this is this is who should be the next Supreme Court justice. Now,
we interviewed President Clinton.
Yep.
And of course, he says, look, a lot of people were lobbying for various people. And he said it was her interview that did it. He talked about what a brilliant legal mind she had, that he called her to the White House on a Sunday evening, and they just spent more than an hour talking about legal issues, constitutional issues, and how to make good law. He was, you know, completely taken with her intellect, as are many people. You know, one of the great interviews, I think, is Senator Orrin Hatch, who was the leading Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he grilled her, had some tough questions for her, but came to and certainly disagrees with her on some issues, but came to respect her tremendously, and she was overwhelmingly approved by the Senate.
Basically, Marty Ginsburg got his wife in the door, and once she was there, she knew what to do.
Yeah, once she passes through a door, it's hard to turn her back. That's my sense.
Exactly.
I mean, you all draw quite a bit on her testimony in front of the Judiciary Committee when she, and I mean, I believe that, what was the final vote? 93-6?
No,
right?
97-3.
97-3. Yeah. And so, what, I mean, obviously it's a different time than we're in now. I mean, it's,
absolutely,
of course, and it was a different time then than it was before that. But that her ability, what she did in those hearings, going back, you must have watched the whole thing and thought about it. What struck you about how she was communicating with the senators?
Well, you know, she, while being unfailingly polite throughout the confirmation hearings, I don't think she ever lost her cool. She was just tough. She showed her intellect. She did the whole teaching thing again. She sort of explained at great length her arguments and the reasoning for her arguments. When she had been a lawyer arguing cases before the Supreme Court, she took the extremely unusual step. It hadn't been done before, and I don't believe it's been done since, of speaking up in favor of illegal abortion rights in a time people weren't doing that. But she did it with such control and such sort of intellectual command that even the senators who were opposed to her ended up saying they agree, saying not that they agreed with her, but they were impressed by her.
That's the voice of Julie Cohen. She's joined here in studio on Your Call by Betsy West, her fellow creator of the new film RBG. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today on Your Call. We're going to be back to talk about the career of Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a justice on the Supreme Court after this break. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We podcast our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to archive programs there and find out what's coming up next. We are in conversation today with the filmmakers behind a new documentary that's going to be coming out on Friday in theaters, Betsy West and Julie Cohen. And their documentary is called RBG. It's all about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When she was simply Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was simply Ruth Bader, her entire life, the arc of that, which is pretty remarkable. And we were just talking before the break about her confirmation to the Supreme Court, about her negotiating that. Talk about what was the court she was entering at that time. Take us back to who was on the Supreme Court at that time and what it meant for there to be a second woman on the court. What the context was she was coming into in terms of that body.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg has always been somebody who's extraordinarily collegial. And I get the impression that in that court in the 1990s, it was a collegial body and she fit right in. If you look at, the Supreme Court decides many, many decisions over the years. A lot of them don't make news, but those that do are the ones that are the big ideological divides. And in that court, she was kind of a moderate, and she considered herself a moderate and somebody who wanted to convince her fellow justices to come her way.
And so what are some examples of cases where there's big ideological things where she was partly a consensus builder, was somebody who'd end up helping build a majority, making those arguments? Maybe talk about you also talk in the film about her relationship with perhaps the most right-wing member of the court, Antonin Scalia.
Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia were very close friends going back to the days when they served together on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The thing that you can kind of lose sight of when you're looking at the court from the outside is so many cases aren't real political hot-button issues. Those two justices actually had a fair amount of legal agreement, particularly on civil procedure, an area of law that they were both kind of like obsessed with. It's like kind of boring, so you don't hear a lot. You're more likely to hear about gay rights and abortion rights cases than you are about the arcane civil procedure stuff. But they had a lot to agree on. Of course, they disagreed on a lot of stuff. During the period of working on this film, we've been asked by a lot of people as we were going through the process, but were they really friends? There's sort of a thought that maybe this was a photo op type friendship.
Like for show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we thought maybe that was the case. But from doing the research, from talking to Justice Ginsburg about Justice Scalia, from looking at the footage of them together, from talking to Justice Scalia's son, of course, Antonin Scalia passed away in 2016, just before we started filming. It became quite clear that, no, this was a real intense, warm, really lovely friendship between these people who shared a lot, who shared great intellect, who shared a passion for the arts, and who felt that their differing ideological views sharpened one another's thinking.
I got the sense of her as a person who really values different styles of people, different intellects, people who are willing to really challenge and get engaged.
Absolutely. One of the things she appreciated about Justice Scalia was the ability to have these debates. There's a great example that he was writing a dissent in a big case where she was writing in the majority. He was writing a rather scathing dissent, and he shared it with her ahead of time. Said, "Look, I'm not quite ready to circulate it to everybody else yet, but I'd like you to have an advance look." She said it ruined her weekend, but it definitely helped her sharpen her argument. So they did have tremendous respect for each other and treated each other in a very collegial way.
But you also trace in the film, the court in a certain way changes around her in the time that she's on the court. And her position in it.
Yes, absolutely. During the presidency of George W. Bush, he had the opportunity to appoint a couple of Supreme Court justices, Samuel Alito and Chief Justice John Roberts, who moved the court significantly to the right. And as the court became more conservative, Justice Ginsburg became more of a dissenting voice. As she pointed out to us, you know, nobody really wants to be the one writing dissents. You'd rather be in majority opinion. You want to be writing the opinion that's going to become the law of the land, and that's not what a dissenter is doing. But when you need to dissent, when you need to speak up, gosh darn it, she's going to do that. And that's, you know, that's become quite a part of her legacy.
Yeah. I mean, she did in the early years. She had a number of decisions where she was in the majority. I mean, I think we should point out the VMI case because it was so important to her. Virginia Military Institute was the last remaining military institute in the country, which was
public
institute that was not allowing women to attend. And a case was brought by the government against the state. And her decision in that case was really the culmination of all the work she'd done as a litigator, basically writing that you cannot exclude women just because they're women. If they can do the job, if they can attend the academy, if they have the physical abilities to do that, then they should be they should be allowed to attend. And she pulled other members of the court to her side. It was a 7-1 decision. Justice Thomas recused himself because his son was attending VMI at the time.
Oh, at the time.
Yeah. But she convinced other justices to come along with her. So that was one of her. That was one of her big victories.
Well, I have to say the one moment in that in your film when I kind of choked up feeling was watching her when she returns to VMI 20 years later, right after the decision is rendered. And just thinking of, okay, here's this longstanding institution where there was incredible resistance to this change. And here is someone who's identified so closely with it going in there and speaking to those cadets and to those alumni and to the people of that community. I don't know why, but there was something about that that really struck me.
It was very moving. We were there, and it was very moving.
Yeah, it was an incredible day. We interview for the film one of those women cadets from the first class of women to graduate from VMI. Her name was Kelly Sullivan, and she showed up for that event and, you know, she told us some stories about how difficult it was for her during that period. As you say, there was very serious resistance from alum and from some students that were just like, you know, why the heck are you here? Echoing, in fact, what, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had experienced earlier in her education and career. And yet, you know, the young women cadets soldiered on, as so to speak, and to see Kelly Sullivan watching Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Kelly, who's a Republican, by the way, you know, being moved by her words and so gratefully appreciating what Justice Ginsburg has done for women. It was a real moving moment for us.
And she is so proud of that. She has a picture of some of the current cadets. There was a picture taken of herself at VMI with some of the cadets. She's so proud of what they're studying, nuclear science, engineering. And I think she's a little proud of the fact that Justice Scalia's prediction that this was going to ruin VMI, which is basically what he said, didn't come true.
If I'm remembering correctly, she said to people at the time, you're going to be proud of these women cadets
right.
who come in and
yes.
graduate,
right.
which I think, obviously, there must have been some of those law professors at Harvard who had some of that, you know, that taught her, who later said, oh, well, here, you know, here's why that was worthwhile giving somebody who we thought maybe didn't belong here that opportunity. And I want to let listeners know we're talking to the directors and producers of RBG, the new film about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life and career, which is opening on Friday in theaters. Betsy West, Julie Cohen, both with us here on Your Call. So she's somebody who at different times said, what's the future of the Supreme Court? Oh, there'll be 3, 4, 5 women on the court. There'll be a future where that just will be normal. Perhaps, who knows? Maybe there'll be 9 women on the
right.
court. And yet that hasn't, well, I mean, there's representation on the court, but a sense of that forward movement around those questions, not as obvious as she might have expected earlier.
I guess, although I think she would say that she's heartened, you know, after Sandra Day O'Connor retired to be joined by two other women who were both appointed during the Obama administration, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. So she now feels like she's part of a a squad mm-hmm. of lady justices, and that's not nothing, but it doesn't necessarily, and you know, I don't think that gender or race is determinative of political views. I would not be surprised if there are more justices appointed during the Trump administration to see some women, you know, to see another woman appointed, but that doesn't mean that it's going to move towards the more liberal court that Trump opponents might be hoping for.
Yeah. Sandra O'Connor, of course, was appointed by President Reagan.
Yeah. And so you talk about this move from her being part of majorities to being more likely to be a dissenter. But of course, it's as a dissenter that she really became more than just another Supreme Court justice. Talk about when and how that happened, right? Where it's like suddenly, like, this is something you see Twitter, you know, the places where you really see people championing somebody who, like, I'm sorry, you watch her speak and you think, this is a very measured, considered, incredibly smart person. Not necessarily somebody you think like a tweet bait.
Yeah, a very unlikely rock star millennial icon, but there it is. And it happened very organically when she issued a very strong decision in the Shelby County case, which dissent in the Shelby County case, in which she objected to the ruling that was going to lift protections for voters in some states where there had been discrimination. And Justice John Roberts said the time had come. Our country has changed. Racism isn't what it was before. And what she wrote was that getting rid of this oversight is like taking down your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet.
It's a great metaphor.
It is a great line, and it was taken up by young women, law students, and people started tweeting about her writing, and memes were going all over the place. You can't spell truth without Ruth, and a blog was started and by a young law student in University of Pennsylvania. Shanna
Knishnik,
thank you, Julie, and called Notorious RBG, and the hashtag Notorious RBG, and that just took off.
So you got to talk with some of those folks who spread those memes, who started this new identity around Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah, I mean, I think it took them a bit by surprise as well. Like, these were, like, law nerds for the most part. Like, you know, this young woman was a law student. She wanted to be, she wanted to be sort of sharing the news about dissents that Justice Ginsburg was writing to her fellow, particularly women law students, and just started this Tumblr, and she's posting stuff and, you know, making the joke Notorious RBG, and it just kind of caught fire. I mean, there's something pretty hilarious about the juxtaposition of this teeny tiny 85-year-old now Jewish grandma with a quiet little voice and the connection to the Notorious B.I.G., a joke that, by the way, Justice Ginsburg loves to make. her big line is like, oh, but we have a lot in common. We were both born and bred in Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, we saw her make that joke a number of times. The crowd always goes wild. She knows when she's got a good line, and she's not afraid to use it. And, you know, putting as the internet folks have, you know, loved to do, putting that little, you know, crown on her head, you know, as the queen and the yes queen and the little, you know, there's some really good internet stuff. And like, it just took off. I mean, truthfully, we've experienced it in the past few weeks as we go along spreading the word about our film. You write something, you put up a meme, people go nuts.
So just to be clear for folks who might not know the Notorious B.I.G., right? Here's a great East Coast rapper, one of these people involved in famous East-West feud. Self was shot, but one of these people who, like, a huge figure in public culture, and here's this connection that they made, they really just kind of made it jump in social media.
Yeah, it just took off. And I think the Saturday Night Live parody of Justice Ginsburg and of people being Ginsburned is with Kate McKinnon doing that sexy little dance, yeah, at the news desk. That also contributed to her notoriety, I think.
But so I think you show in that you show her watching some of those SNL skits, yeah, and so as is so often the case, there's kind of what happens in the kind of media where people are layering on, photoshopping XYZ. And then there's this connection to this real person who continues her work. I have a question, because you all talk about how, you know, this moment where she publicly criticizes Donald Trump when he's a candidate, says some things that I think are pretty unusual for a Supreme Court justice to say, saying, I can't imagine what this place would be. I can't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president. She says, for the court, it could be, I don't even want to contemplate that. So this was an unusual moment, a troubling moment for a lot of people who might have been fans of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What do you think happened there? And does it have anything to do with this greater public role that she had that she might not have had before?
It's hard for me to know what motivated that. I think she was speaking genuinely from her heart and mind. And, you know, but the issue is, as a Supreme Court justice, you need to maintain a certain degree of impartiality. And I think the consensus among people that understand how the law works is pretty wide, including ultimately from herself, that those are remarks that she shouldn't have made, regardless of what she feels in her heart. She made the point, though, that to say that, you know, you can't judge fairly and rule with impartiality just because of what your own personal political views might be is too high a standard, and that she can still, you know, she certainly is still deciding cases based on the law. But she's made some remarks. You know, there are those on the left who actually love that she said that. They're kind of like, go justice. They don't, you know, they're not too concerned about what court protocol is. But clearly, as you suggest, a big break from how things are done.
And she apologized after a few days. She realized that and as she has said, it would have been best had she said nothing. And I think that's what she believes.
Yeah, and of course, we know Supreme Court justices have political ideas, right? You hear that in the conversations they make, in the arguments, and the way they talk about things. There's no question that these are as plugged in a people as you get to what's going on in American politics. But it was that speaking out, I think, that for some people crossed the line.
Yeah. Right. I mean, is there anyone who's shocked to hear that those are her views? Probably not. Still in all, as she says, better not to articulate them.
So there's the impact that the whole notorious RBG thing has had in social media, but she's really had a profound impact for young women in law. And you got to see some of that. What has it meant for them to have her as someone on the court?
Well, everywhere we went, every law school that we went where she speaks, Supreme Court justices often go to law schools to speak, but when RBG is there, there is a line around the block. They are just inspired by her example. It's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. In coming years, whether there's an increase in female applications to law school, which is already high, which is already, you know, around or sometimes breaking the 50-50 mark. But I actually think that her cultural importance is enough that you're going to find more women wanting to go to law school, which I think in her mind would be a better outcome than the proliferation of RBG tattoos, which are becoming a thing and of which she is not a fan. You know, are people going to start naming more daughters Ruth? I would truly not be surprised. Like, people are that into her. My middle name is Ruth, so I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been proud of my middle name, but until now, actually, someone even asked me, because I have a Ruth in my Gmail, and someone asked me, like, oh, did you add that because of the RPG documentary? I was like, no, that's actually my name.
You know, what kind of amazes me are the little girls. The 7, 8, and 9-year-old girls who dress up like RBG for Halloween, and or who dress up like RBG to come to our screenings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of amazing that little girls see her and identify with her. Maybe it's the grandmother thing and the combination. She doesn't look like a threatening person. There are children's books about RBG. She is a true hero for the next millennial generation, whatever we call the post-millennial millennials.
We had a little girl in a screening yesterday ask the first question, second grader. She said, actually, I have a comment, not a question, which sometimes which sometimes people say, but when they're in second grade, it's adorable. And she said, I've read three books. I'm a fan of Justice Ginsburg's, and I have read three books about her. I mean, the child is 8 years old. So there's something about her that's really striking a chord. And, you know, to me, very encouraging also is frankly, is Justice Ginsburg's age becoming a role model like this? Because, you know, our society is a youth-worshipping society. So the idea of little girls looking at this 85-year-old woman and thinking she's so cool, I mean, it's pretty awesome.
And she, well, I think in some ways, I mean, I got the sense that she's emerged as this icon in part because, yes, she goes against type, right? And she is, like, you show her working out, you show her taking care of her body in this way that, I mean, we shouldn't not associate with older people, with older women. But there's something about seeing her doing that, that I'm sorry, you watch that on film, it's quite powerful.
Yeah, we'd heard about her legendary workout. She talked about the fact that she works out with a trainer twice a week and mentioned that she does real push-ups and planks. Didn't quite believe it until we asked her whether or not we waited for a while before we asked her. We finally asked her if we could come in and film her in the gym. When we got in there and saw the way that she attacks her workout routine, the kind of determination that she applies, we understood exactly why she was happy to have us film it, because I think she's proud of keeping herself in shape. And yeah, she's a role model for millennials, and I guess she's a role model for older women as well for keeping going.
And so she's gone through this process on the court where at one time she was helping write majority decisions, and now she's regularly dissenting. I think many people had asked the question during the Obama administration, should she step down, make it possible for President Obama to appoint a younger judge who might be on the court for longer? But she's not going anywhere. How do you understand that decision and kind of where she sees herself at this point?
Yeah, I think her thought, she's said it, we've certainly heard her say it many times, that she's going to stay on the court as long as she can do her job full steam. She sort of pointed out in response to some of those critics that in fact Obama did have the opportunity to appoint a justice, almost a year before he was going to leave office, and Merrick Garland, a moderate who was blocked and never appointed, so never rose to being a Supreme Court justice. So
what would it have done?
Also noteworthy is that she has named upcoming clerks for not just one term, but through 2020, certainly sending a signal that she intends to be on the court through a term, at least, of a Trump presidency. So, from what we've seen of her, she's like, when she says she's going to do something, she tends to do it. So, I take that message from her seriously.
Yeah, I think that in addition to keeping herself in physical shape, she's in great mental shape. Julie and I had the experience of having Justice Ginsburg correct us on a small detail involving a case from 40 years ago. She has an amazing memory for names and details. She still stays up late into the night working on her writing, crafting her dissents. She doesn't show signs that she's going anywhere in the immediate future.
No, you talk to her kids and they talk about how she works,
yeah.
Which I thought was really, because, obviously Supreme Court justice has to assimilate a huge amount of information, these people are working incredibly hard no matter how many clerks they've got.
Right.
But talk a little bit about what you learned about just how she does that work.
Well, the main secret is working hard and diligently late into the night. That's been her secret throughout her career. Her childhood friends say that's how she was when she was a high school student, and her now grown children say that their recollections from childhood would be, by the time they were getting into bed or already in bed, she would still be at the dining room table with her legal pads laid out and her box of prunes and some ice cream. Working working on briefs when she was a lawyer, and now she does the same thing as a justice. Now, she makes up for that by sleeping very late on weekends, something that we did witness when we did some filming in her home on a weekend. Her granddaughter met us at the door, and the justice was just getting up and going because it was a Saturday, and she sleeps late on the weekends.
I would love to talk to a sleep researcher about what the ultimate effect that has on your body and mind.
Yeah, I think you're not supposed to do it.
You're not supposed to.
It seems to work for her.
It seems to be her rhythm. That's her body rhythm, and she goes with it.
Well, it's hard to argue with the results for her, right? You say here's someone who's incredibly present and incredibly vibrant at an age when a lot of people aren't. So it's pretty amazing. For you, making this film, who's Ruth Bader Ginsburg to you before and after making it? What her... You know, what she means to you, what you take from her experience in reflecting on your own.
You know, it's such an honor to have made a film, to have the opportunity to make a film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think that our respect for the challenges that she's met in her life and the things that she has accomplished has deepened. And we've tried to, I think in my case, I've tried to learn some of the lessons that she learned from her mother who always used to say, don't waste your time with useless emotions, with anger. Ruth Bader Ginsburg had some tough times in her life, and she pushed through and thought very carefully about how to accomplish what she wanted in a very, let's say, measured and successful way.
Julie Cohn.
To me, it's her determination that really sticks with me. You know, when you see what she was up against early in her education and her career, and just, it just seems like things that would have kind of crushed the spirit of a lot of people, where you'd wake up the next day and be like, oh my God, I'm going to keep fighting this fight. And like, she was just always pushing those fights. You know, when she, and you see it now when she exercises, the look on her face when she's planking, like she's gonna do this, like, and that's a path to success.
The film is RBG. It is about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her life and career. The filmmakers Julie Cohn and Betsy West, thank you so much for being with us today on Your Call. Any final thoughts before we go?
Do your push-ups and your planks.
Do your planks, lift your weights, and keep pushing forward.
I'm Matt Martin, filling in for Rose Aguilar today on Your Call. You can always hear past shows or sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. To listen to past shows, that is where they're at. You can also follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email show ideas to yourcall@kalw.org. Julie, Betsy, thank you so much for being with us today. I want to thank our producer, Laura Wenis, and Malihe Razazan. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Matt Martin, and this is Your Call.